I don't want to keep you all up and you're desperate to get to bed or something, but I've got these slides now, and I've got a green one, which is the first one there. I think if you guys can click on it and you know how to then go to the second one, that'd be great. But I'll do them one at a time. They're only really, I was talking to Paddy about this, they're only really sort of little focus points, really. I don't want this to be a sort of big slideshow per se. It's just that if I think people are just talking, I think sometimes the tendency is for, you know, people can sort of drift away in some ways, and not that I mind that, you know, probably best thing you can do if I'm talking, but I thought it just helps sort of focus the mind on the subject, as it were. So this evening we're talking on the climate and the biodiversity crisis, and it is pretty clear to people that share our views, I think, that this can't really be divorced from all the other things, and I'll come on to that. Now, Paddy did mention a technical problem earlier on. I wanted to thank Paddy because he's helped me put these slides on so you can see them. The technical problem, he omitted to say, was me. So that's the technical problem. Anyway, this first one here, just the opening slide there. I wanted to talk about all of us, really, because one of the things I sense that when we talk together on Fridays and everyone's chatting, there's a sense of, it's wonderful, the feeling's wonderful, because you kind of sense that everyone is has the same mindset as you, and you all believe in the same thing, and this is why we're all together now talking. But the great problem with that is that we're not usually, there may be the odd visitor, and one hopes there is, and one would hope that those numbers would increase, but in the reality of life is that we are very few. And this is, I think, is a problem. So what I'd like to try and think of, not necessarily in this presentation here, but I think a very important thing is to think about how we share our thoughts and our beliefs in, and what we believe will be a better way of life, and how we share that with other people. And recently I started sort of reading a few books and looking at sort of the psychology of it all, and it's very, very interesting, because you could argue that it applies to us. We believe a certain thing, and when we talk about that to other people, if someone challenges us, we'll take the tiniest shred of evidence sometimes, although in our minds, of course, it isn't a tiny shred of evidence, but and we'll sort of hang on to that to sort of support our cause. And I think people do this quite a lot. And I guess what I'm saying is that I think sometimes if one is trying to talk to people about the issues of climate change, climate breakdown, as it's often called as well, or socialism, it might be a useful tack sometimes, I think, to sort of, if you like, get them to sort of present their thoughts and say, and you might say to them, well, okay, that's interesting. How would you perceive us getting from point A to point B, point B being a good place to be and point A being the bad place to be? And I think by doing that, you're kind of, without even a mention of politics or socialism, you can begin to get people around to making your case for you. And I guess that's certainly something that I try and do when one is talking about the climate and the biodiversity thing. Anyway, so I think that's a good approach. But otherwise, I feel that, you know, we don't really want to always be talking to ourselves, enjoyable though it is, because I was talking to Paddy about this earlier, and it would be really lovely if we can sort of develop something somehow with our current social media platforms to try and, if you like, get these thoughts out in a way that invites people to, if you like, come up with the ideas themselves rather than present them with something that we perceive, although we absolutely, you know, believe in it. And I get that. And of course I do. We all share this same belief. But what we've got to realize is a very few people, other people do. And I think, as I said earlier, I think the key thing there is they've already got a set of beliefs that they've been, you know, conditioned to think either via school or their work or their peers or whatever. And most people find it incredibly challenging when someone says something to them and they've then got to sort of question their entire lives sometimes. So I think a useful way in when one is talking about climate change and how terrible and frightening that is to kind of get them to almost plan out the route and almost make your argument for you. I won't dwell anymore because I've said enough about that. It is difficult, I know, and I'm sure some of you must have this problem when you're talking to, you know, your nearest and dearest or your best friends or whatever, and they kind of say something like, you know, change the record. But it is frustrating. But the problem is, for socialists, I think, that, you know, if it's the same problem, so it's the same answer. And so no doubt, if you're like me, and I'm sure people, all of you think like this, everything you listen to on the radio seems to have the same answer, and all the problems all come back to the same thing. But let's get cracking with the climate thing. There is no doubt about what's going on at the moment. The majority of peer-reviewed papers and scientists say with absolute clarity that this is happening, and it is a man-made issue, and it's the burning of fossil fuels. I'd like to go to that other slide, the second one now, which should show planet Earth. Now, it's very interesting, this, because there is nowhere else to go. This is where we live on this particular planet. And we are effectively, I say we, you know, the society we live in is very happy, it would seem, to sort of pretty much burn the resources it has. It's like being on a spaceship where you're just eating up all your fuel, eating up all your food. That's pretty much where we are. But it could be different, and it could be wonderfully different. And this is where I think we need to sort of share our ideas with people and, if you like, hopefully get them to sort of buy into this. Now, there are a lot of people that, for some reason, I must admit, this is something I really don't understand. Why is it that these very, very wealthy people, Elon Musk is the obvious one one might pluck out, you know, this current year, his personal worth was $174.6 billion. It's just absolutely astonishing, this sort of thing. And he is actually seriously considering going to another planet. So although I joke about there is no other planet, sadly, for some people there is. There is so much money swimming around with these wealthy people that they are seriously now considering going to another planet. I was also thinking, as I've no doubt a lot of you did, that the COVID issue, this pandemic that's hit us last year, would, if you like, trigger a kind of, you know, almost trigger socialism by the fact that people started to do all these wonderful things. They started to act as communities. They started to help each other. They started to talk to each other on the streets. All the things that we would think would normally happen in a socialist society. Furthermore, they began to think in very creative ways. So they were looking at other places, you know, obviously they had to work from home sometimes. So they were thinking, how can they do that? And this then triggered all this, effectively triggered, with all the lack of transport and driving and everything, the largest annual drop in CO2 emissions since World War II. That was last year, 2020. So this proves very clearly that things can happen quickly, which is another argument people often throw at you. They'll say, oh, well, socialism, yeah, we might get there one day, but, you know, as long as we're doing something to sort of, you know, little by little. And I'm afraid I lose patience there a bit, because actually we've already seen with absolute clarity that things can happen very, very quickly indeed. The vaccine would be another example of that. So that is not an argument against socialism, and it's not either an argument against doing something about our changing climate, which will have and is having devastating effects on animals, the environment, and indeed people. The International Energy Agency is now predicting, with all this talk of return to normality, and I say normality in inverted commas, as you all know, that, you know, our perception of normality is not where we were. But anyway, they're saying that the surge, when all this economy is kind of rebooted, if you like, will be about 1.5 billion tons this year. And that's what they're predicting. And it also is predicting that that will be the largest carbon emission ever. So with all this talk of, you know, rhetoric in governments about doing something about this, that and the other, and the environmental crisis and fossil fuel and carbon emissions, we're now heading for probably, you know, the worst year on record as this economy steers into a crisis. Sorry, steers away from a financial crisis. They're trying to recover from it, to use their terms, the global financial crisis. But what they don't consider is, I'm looking at my notes here. What about the human crisis? I mean, this is the thing that is so unbelievably frightening and sad, that world governments are sort of talking about a financial crisis and there's no mention of a human crisis. It's all about finance. Okay, let's go on. Now, there's three slides in a row here. And they're just put in, really. You don't need reminding, any of you guys, obviously, that the climate issue and the biodiversity issue is all part of one and the same problem. We all know that. But this is quite interesting as well, because I read a book recently, and if I may, I'll suggest that those of you that haven't read it, and I know that most of you are far more better read than I am and far more knowledgeable about any number of things than I am. But there is a recent book, a very recent book, and it's by a chap called Michael Mann. Some of you may have read it, and it's called The New Climate War. And the reason I mention that book is because I'm going to quote from it, and I'm also going to allude to it and refer to it, I should say, in a few slides. But what he said in that book, at one point, he said that he felt, and he gave some what I believe he sort of quoted a scientist or someone who said that the human race, if you like, us, cannot deal with more than one thing at a time. So if you talk to them, like we do as socialists, about the inherent problems of the world, and we say, you know, they're all part of the same issue. So you've got homelessness, and as you scroll up, you've got starvation, you've got pollution, you've got warfare. These are all things that are very, very much direct outcomes of a capitalist system. And I don't think I need to dwell on why that is, but we all know. And if you don't, you've only got to start researching them in any depth, and you very quickly arrive at the fact that it comes down to the system we live in that dictates that these things happen. You know, it all, the first two, obviously, homelessness. You wouldn't choose to sleep on the street if you could afford to have a roof over your head. You wouldn't starve if you could afford to have some food. Pollution is a result of the worst possible ways of making society run. Warfare is, again, protection of territory, of military routes, of access routes to minerals and so on and so forth. So we all know that these are a direct result of capitalism. Okay, so, sorry, I've just flicked my slides there. I'm in a point where I'm just going back up here, so forgive this sort of slight hesitant bit. Right, let's go on to the next slide. It should say the action graph. Now, I'm afraid, you've already completely understood that I'm hopeless with technology. I was hoping to give you a little graph here, but I was going to give it to you with no real knowledge of what I was going to put on it. So this is a thought, and it's a thought that perhaps if we get time, we could discuss it. I'd be welcome other people's views on this, but it's just something I was thinking about the other day, and it's not a graph, obviously. I've written action graph, but clearly it isn't. But I was hoping to sort of work on, if you like, a little pie chart or a graph of some form that would illustrate how capitalism works and how it, if you like, sustains itself, if you like. It's able to keep itself going. And I say it as if it's an animal in its own right or an organism in its own right. In a bizarre sort of way, it sort of is. But let's just look at this slide, if you bear with me. If you think about it, I'm very lucky. Well, I live in a quite a nice place in the Welsh-English border. I met you guys. My mother and my grandfather used to be members of the Socialist Party. So I have I do know about the party, and those thoughts have been not, you know, I wasn't forced into any way of thinking. I came around to thinking that way myself. But let's just look at another outcome. Let's say, for instance, I wasn't lucky enough to have those thoughts shared with me. And I say I was in a situation where I was in a very tough area, a really difficult, poor part of the city. You know, those sorts of places which are huge, let's face it, these are the people that live in poverty are the vast majority of people on the planet. Now, they don't have the luxury of doing what we're doing now, arguably. Well, certainly don't have the luxury of what I was doing last night, sitting around a table with a glass of wine, chatting to my friends about, you know, about the world and all these things. They are struggling to put food on a plate, wonder where their job's going to come from, are they going to have a job? Any number of things like that. By dint of the fact of where they live, they probably have to think, oh, can, you know, the child has to walk 4 miles to get to a well to get some water. So what I'm saying here is, under capitalism, the vast majority of people probably haven't got time, or they just simply can't sit back and think about the biodiversity crisis or indeed any of the ills of capitalism. That said, those people are probably going to be the people that are going to be most affected by it as the sea levels rise, or the water becomes unavailable to them, or their crops are trashed by the temperatures. And indeed, there are parts of the world where the temperature is going to get so hot that the human body sweating won't be enough to stop death, basically. It just won't be enough to sort that problem out. So, and then you get, if you like, to the, what I would call the comfortably off. And I could possibly put myself in this. I mean, I don't struggle for food. I've got enough to, you know, I've got a roof over my head and all those sorts of things. And I think there's a lot of people like this, possibly a lot of people better off than me, who kind of feel good about themselves because they've got a big car. They bought into a lifestyle. They buy a magazine that tells them that if they've got this car, you know what, they've arrived, and they feel good about that. It's a very psychological thing, and they have their friends around. They say, oh yeah, you know, we go down to the farmer's market, isn't it wonderful, and we buy Fred's cabbages and they're really lovely, and they're organically grown, and they're kind of chatting on like this, and they sort of feel they're doing their thing. But what they're not really doing is thinking in a wider sense about how much better the world could be for the vast, vast majority of people. They kind of quench their consciousness, if you like, by doing these odd things. I'm not having a go at them at all here. What I'm saying is that all these states of mind of people are inevitable products of capitalism. And I think that's a really sad thing, because I've come across it so much with people. I've probably said this to you before, actually, some of you anyway, in a talk I did years ago. But when the Stern report came out, I was heavily involved in sort of environmental stuff up in the Arctic at that time. But when that Stern report came out, you may remember that. At the time, I was working in Sevenoaks in Kent, which is a very, very affluent area. And the people there, bless them, they have quite a sense of entitlement. And if you think, well, that's a bit of a generalization, I can tell you I worked there 35 years and I met about 80 people a week. So I got a pretty clear picture of what they were like. And I suspect a lot of the M25 corridor is like that. But anyway, to cut a long story short, this lady came to the door. I was going to meet her to talk about some work. And she's heavily pregnant. And I said to her, oh, you know, little baby on the way. And I said, well, what did you think about, you know, the environment and with the, you know, the Stern report? And she said to me, and I'm not paraphrasing this, she said, oh, we're quite wealthy. I don't think it'll affect us. And so what I'm saying there is that is the comfortably off kind of approach. You know, those are the sorts of people that might go out and join a little litter picking group at the weekend or something like that. But what they just don't quite want to do is change the world, because it sort of suits them okay. And then you've got the third group, and this is the extremely wealthy. These are the people who their own personal wealth could without any problem, without really noticing it, vaccinate the entire world against COVID, or pay off one of the poorer countries' entire debts, those sorts of people. Now, they are the people that kind of confuse me, really, because they, assuming they still had children, they've still got a world, you know, ahead of them, if you like, their children. So I'd be interested to hear what other members felt about that. And why is it that those people actually don't mourn the loss of species, or they don't mourn the loss of beauty? I don't really get that one. I really don't. Unless they literally just think they've got so much money, they can do what Elon Musk was talking about and go to another planet. Perhaps they do. Okay. While we're still on these slides, the ones went before, I just noticed a couple of comments that on my notes here. Now, that book I was telling you about, and hopefully some of you will be able to read it or get it from the library or something, if libraries are open, I don't know if they are. Just a reminder, Michael Mann, The New Climate War. Now, in this book, it's a good read, fairly easy to read. I don't agree at all with his answer, but I'd be interested to later date to hear what some of you think. He mentions profits and record profits many, many times. So as an economist, I suspect he still feels that this is the thing that has to carry on existing. But what he does do that is interesting, and I think this would interest socialists when he's talking about climate change, he divides people into groups. So you've got what he calls activists, who may be people like that join Extinction Rebellion or Greenpeace and those sorts of people. He's got people that are called inactivists. And these are people that, this is his description, incidentally. I'm not necessarily agreeing with it. I'm just telling you what he said. He's got inactivists, and he really doesn't like them because they are people that say basically, oh, it's all going to hell in a handcart anyway, so what's the point of doing anything? He's also talks a lot about doomists. Now, doomists might be actually, again, activists as well. So they could be like Extinction Rebellion. And I don't know if any of you have looked at Extinction Rebellion stuff, but the main chap, you know, the chap with the long hair, the top bod, you know, he's pretty much saying, you know, we're all going to die in, you know, a couple of years' time if we don't do something about it. He calls these people doomists. He doesn't like them either. And he also talks about soft doomists and so on. But anyway, again, to sort of try and clarify what I'm saying there is, one of the interesting things he does here is talks about how all these different people deal with climate change and biodiversity collapse and all this sort of thing. But what he points out is a couple of interesting points. I won't go through the whole thing because it's a book, this whole book, but there are, behind the scenes, you've got the Koch brothers and the big fossil fuel companies, and what they are doing, and this is an extremely well-researched book. It's not just him guessing this. What they are doing is they're feeding into Twitter feeds and so on and so forth, and all the social media platforms, and they are in kind of firing up, how shall I put it, little mini wars, if you like. So They're saying to vegans, oh, you know, you should attack anyone who eats beef because they're awful. And then they're saying to beef eaters, oh, you know, vegans are dreadful. They're going to take all our burgers. So a lot of this sort of stuff's going on. And then there's people that started saying, if you're flying, you're going to destroy the planet. It's called flight shaming now. It's become quite a big thing. And I suspect those comfortably off people I told you about, probably around their dinner tables, have will be having the odd conversation where someone goes, oh, I don't fly anymore. And the other one says, oh, dreadful flying. And they're kind of, what the point he's making is, it's a kind of divide and rule thing. So what's happening is you're not getting a united reaction against the big fossil companies. They're quite happy with this to go on because everyone's fighting each other. The vegans are fighting the burgers, the burger eaters, and so on and so forth. And the people that want to live in a, you know, yurt, fighting the people that are flying, and so it goes on. But it's all great because it means that no one is fighting the Koch brothers or the fossil fuel companies. He also says in his book a very interesting thing, and those of you, if you've got a pen and paper handy, have a look at this because it's interesting. If you go onto YouTube and you just type in crying Indian advert, some of you may even know it, I don't know. It came out in 1970. And on the surface of it, I looked at it last night. And if you get a chance, take a look at it. It's called, just type in on YouTube, crying Indian advert, 1970, and you should get it. Anyway, what this was, this thing, and you'll see it, it's a Native American Indian paddling a canoe, and it kicks off with him paddling a canoe down this river. And you kind of assume it's sort of, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and it's all terribly, you know, Native American and so on, you know, First Nation person. And then eventually you see sort of paddling into an industrial area. Then he comes out onto the edge of this river, and it's covered with plastic bottles and rubbish and everything else. And he stands up and he starts crying. Anyway, the advert basically is saying to people, you know, do you want your planet to look like this, you bastards? It doesn't say you bastards, but the implication is there. It's saying it's your fault your planet is like this, and pick up litter. And so coming back to Michael Mann's book, he also alludes to this, and he says it's a very, very convenient way of operating in capitalism, because these companies, incidentally, that crying Indian advert, I believe, was paid for by Coca-Cola. So people were chucking plastic bottles away. So what do Coca-Cola do? They don't stop making or deal with the problem themselves. They shift the guilt and the responsibility onto people. And I definitely don't want to say ordinary people. You know what I mean. So it shifts away from them. So they carried on as normal. And you had all these sort of people feeling terrible about all this and going litter picking and everything else. And you get the point. I don't think I need to say more about that. Okay. Incidentally, I'll just mention this because I don't, you know, I think this pandemic, as I mentioned earlier, is, you know, bears another mention, simply because I mentioned earlier that it would have been lovely if that socialism had kind of been spawned from that awful thing, or this awful thing, I should say. But one of the tragedies of all this, of course, is that during this pandemic year, the world's wealthiest, their personal wealth has risen by £10.2 trillion. I wonder what they did. I half thought maybe they're out in their backyards knocking out masks or something, but no, they weren't. They were betting on whether the economy was going to recover. So that's how they made that money. Jeff Bezos personally benefited himself, one man, from $74 billion. You know, it is absolutely astonishing. I'm a bit conscious of my time here because I don't want to whittle on too long. So I'm just going to go on to the next slide. Obviously, with Wildlife Trust, there's a slide you should be seeing now, charities. It's just a simple point, really. I've made this point so many times, but as I said in the earlier part of the chit-chat, that the problems are the same, so the answers are the same. So really, there are a lot of these charities you can see on the screen now. None of them are actually to do with biodiversity, but we all know there are a lot of those. You've got the wildlife trusts and all the rest of them, RSPB and so on and so forth. And I subscribe to a magazine called British Wildlife, and that magazine has huge numbers of articles written by some very, very clever nature writers and so on, and including a lady called Sue Everett, who writes about conservation and issues at the end of the magazine every couple of months. And it is quite clear to see that these problems are all over the place. Now, very often, when they talk about the problems in the magazine, it comes down to lack of money or withdrawal of government funds or whatever it is. So I guess my point is here that, like everything else, it doesn't matter what your charity's for, it doesn't work. But what it does do is give the government a good feeling, you know, we all know how these charities are plugged, you know, here on sort of Radio 4 Appeal and all the rest of it. And again, it comes down, if you like, again, to the crying Indian, you know, it's your fault that this is happening, so give money to it, do something about it, it's your fault. And it's a bloody clever thing, because all the time people think they're doing something about it through charitable work, they're not. They're actually doing the opposite, which is a problem. I say it's a problem because I've had so many conversations with various charities and saying, you know, that you know, why are you doing this, why don't you go for the big problem? But they kind of glaze over, as they do, we all know what it's like. There should be another slide now. And I've mentioned beauty here, and this is really close to my heart, and because the environment is beautiful, generally speaking. And what I think we face as a problem here is this biodiversity crisis that we're seeing unfold in front of us is basically comes down to the loss of species. Now, some species can cope to a degree. I mean, some are benefiting, actually. Some plants are benefiting and will do from warming temperatures. There will be some that thrive. Others won't. Alpine plants, for example, those plants that are high up on hills or mountains in what they call a sort of Arctic refugio, if you like. Some of those won't, because, you know, they will die out. Now, a lot of people might say, well, so what? You know, few plants dying out, what's the big deal? But we're not just talking about plants. We're talking about oceans that are ceasing to function because of the heat. I've been doing some work recently with some scientists from the New University of Southampton, and these guys are experts in coral bleaching, and that's what the work I've been doing. It's a sculptural project, I should say. I'm not a scientist, I'm a sculptor, and that's what I'm doing with them. But it was very, very enlightening indeed, because climate change and warming temperatures of oceans are killing off. We've all heard of the Great Barrier Reef. Now, that's had a terrible year in 2020. But it's not just there. It's all the coral reefs. And coral reefs are hugely, hugely important to the biodiversity of the oceans. And that's not known, because people don't see it. It's all under the ocean. So it's not something that's seen. They might hear a bit about the Great Barrier Reef. They might even know where it is. But the majority of people won't have seen it. So what I'm saying is, yes, you know, some plants may thrive, but an awful lot of species won't. And it will affect humans to the point of making it very, very difficult for probably the poorest people to carry on living any semblance of a normal life. Okay, so this is the thing that's changing most of all, of course, in this is in terms of species and diversity, is a thing called phenology, which I'm sure you all know what that means. But basically what it means is, let's say in here where I live on the Welsh-English border, the springs are becoming earlier and earlier and earlier. The summers are getting hotter and longer. You know, some people think, oh, great, that's really good. But in reality, what's happening is the caterpillars that might have emerged are emerging earlier. The birds' phenology, their life patterns don't link up with that. So they start to die out because they're not being able to eat the things they would normally eat, and so on and so forth. The whole, the way it all knits together is being affected. That's what I'm saying. Now, again, you know, that's, you know, you could say, well, why is that why should that bother us? Well, I think it should bother us, because beauty is something that in a socialist world would be as important as anything else. It gives life. It makes people feel good. It makes them feel wonderful. And in a socialist world, that would take a very, very high preference. And it would probably be intrinsic, actually, to almost everything, even the making of products. You know, things would be made to function well. They'd had no built-in obsolescence and they'd look beautiful. And I think all this is very important. But what we shouldn't forget is, in capitalism, beauty has really no value. HS2, classic example of that, you know. I'll come on to that a bit in a minute. We just move on. So, you know, this is a bunch of dandelions, if you can see them on your slides there. I mean, that's a weed, if you like. I mean, a weed, as we all know, is a plant that's growing where we don't want it. But effectively, you know, it's a weed, but it's beautiful, and you don't have to go very far to see something like that. And the next slide, this is a little bird picture I took in my garden of a chaffinch. But these things, you know, there's greenfinch, I should say, in where we are, has pretty much died out, some awful sort of stuff they chucked on them, the field. So I think these things are beautiful. I think these things are worth fighting for. And I think when we talk about socialism to people, we should perhaps start to focus on beauty and say, you know, try and engage people in conversation and say, well, what do you like looking at? What feels good to you? This is free, this stuff. You know, you can look at it and feel great, you know. And I think that sort of stuff is very, very important to engage people in conversation with, because if they can start to understand that they could lose that, and, you know, why are they losing it, then perhaps they might shift their thought processes a bit. The next one is a little blue butterfly I took. I don't really want to show you loads of my pictures, but I would suggest to you that is a very beautiful creature. Okay. HS2, well, we all know about that. The sad thing, of course, about all this is that in the COVID pandemic, you know, when the first lockdown happened, they all shot out all these sort of companies that were involved with this and started felling all the trees because no one was going to complain. It's pretty awful stuff. Let's move on to the next slide, please. It should show a few trees and a bluebell wood. And the reason I put this in, this is the sort of thing that's being destroyed to shave a few minutes off a journey to Birmingham, Manchester, or Liverpool from London. Now, that's the semi-natural ancient woodland. A bluebell is what's known as I'm sure you'll know this, so forgive me if you do, but it's an indicator plant. So it takes one hell of a long time to establish a woodland like that. And again, I would suggest to you that that is beautiful. And yes, by destroying that, you know, you can put a railway in and you can shave time off, but just check out the reasons for all that. Governments will say, yes, it's provided jobs. But for heaven's sake, you know, it's provided jobs at what cost? And, we don't need to provide jobs unless, you know, it's only to basically carry on this economic system. That's the jobs. These jobs aren't there because they want people to be happy. They want to keep the economic system going. And so they're quite happy to see something like this. And it's not just that one, incidentally. There's dozens of them being completely destroyed. And, of course, once they pop these sort of pathetic little whips in tubes, believe me, and I know because I worked for 35 years as a tree surgeon and a tree consultant, they don't give a monkeys about what happens to them afterwards. They shrivel and dry up, die. They don't care, I promise you that. You will never get that back. Incidentally, on the subject of trees and ecosystems and wildlife, when I was at college, we were asked to look at a woodland like this, and there were half a dozen of us standing around looking at it, and the tutor said to us, tell me about what you're seeing. And so people were saying, okay, that's sweet chestnut, it's very useful for doing this and it can be sold for that and blah 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 blah. And all they were seeing, and they were looking at a wood rather similar to this, were the trees and what affected them, what their, you know, if you like, the career prospects were, how they saw that knitted into their job descriptions, if you like. So the point I'm making is that the tutor then said to us, okay, now shut your eyes and tell me what you hear. And it was quite astonishing, the experience, because we did shut our eyes and the whole place was alive with birds and it sounded absolutely astonishing. And so what I'm saying here is it's very easy to sort of go down, rather like I said at the outset, when people have a set of ideas, they kind of want to cling on to them, and maybe they don't want to open up to other ideas. And we have seen, actually, with the COVID thing, that people have started to think, do you know what? I really like the sound of birds in my garden. And it's not only that, the fact that people haven't traveled so much has meant there have been far more birds in their garden. Okay. I'm just going to move on. I've got here a death by a cat, thousand cuts, I've said. I mean, I use that phrase, I put it in there just as a thought thing, really. When I was involved with that Arctic project, this might be a point for discussion, I don't know really, but I was involved with Jonathan Porritt at the time, and we were talking then about climate change, and this was years ago, and you probably all know Jonathan Porritt is a bit of a sort of he was worked with Friends of the Earth, I think it was, and various other groups. But I was talking to him, and he said that he described climate change as being death by a thousand cuts to me. I met him in London, and that's what he said. And I suppose at the point he was making, it wasn't like litter where people feel, you know, affronted and they get terribly angry. Climate change is sort of very slow. And it's because it's not immediate and affecting anyone in a massive way, admittedly some people it might be, it gets almost tolerated, if you see what I mean. And that was the point he was making. Okay, and the next couple of slides are, there's some coral here. And I put this in because this is just a couple of the images I've been sort of working around. And you can see the first one. I think you'll agree that's fairly beautiful, the colours. And then you move on and you get a bleached coal. This is out of sight and out of mind. So you kind of wonder how many people really, if you like, care about it. But again, we're talking about beauty and the loss of beauty. Okay. I've got another slide. Again, there's a picture of ice. This is another big issue with climate change, and we all know about this one. And that is when the Arctic ice is melting and threatening species, and polar bears, the obvious iconic species that's being threatened by this, and we all know that. But it's far more to it than that. But in other words, there are a lot of species that are being affected. But interestingly, one of the things that comes from tragedy, if you like, is opportunity. And because this Arctic ice is melting, the Northwest Passage, for example, is becoming accessible. So shipping can now go through it. And we all know that companies, you know, Norway, Russia, China, Canada, America, they're all vying for territory up there. And they want that territory not because they like looking at ice or snow geese or, you know, spotting the odd caribou. They want it for drilling and they want it for minerals and everything else. So this is the sad and awful thing that capitalism throws up. You can take the same example with warfare. It's a very, very good opportunity for arms dealers. It's a really, really great thing for arms dealers, even like development companies rebuilding smashed cities and so on and so forth. So it's such an odd thing, you know, that terrible things can be opportunities. The next slide will show... forgive me, some of you may have seen this one before. It's a pallet load of pizzas. The reason I put this in was that when I was up in the Arctic, a lot of the Inuit people live in these little, they're effectively nomadic people, I should say, and that's certainly 100 years ago how they were, but the Canadian government wanted to sort of stay in one place. But they used to live, you know, in harmony with the land. But recently, because the Canadian government don't want to pay too much money, they get terribly upset if the Inuit people have to be flown to a hospital with an illness or something. They really, really don't like that. And they're trying to forcefully resettle them in these dreadful tower blocks in places like Nuuk and so on. But they will happily fly up this stuff into these remote Arctic settlements. And you've only got to look at that and think, well, that's why children in the Arctic are getting obese and suffering from diabetes. I mean, these are plane loads of this stuff. I mean, that Pepsi stuff, is the weight is phenomenal. And all it is sugary water. But they'll take that up. It's utterly awful. Forget. Okay, I've got the next slide. There's a COVID. We talked about COVID. I'd mentioned it. I mean, it's got nothing to do, arguably, with biodiversity. But I think the reason I'd sort of keep bringing it up is because it does show, A, that things can be dealt with quickly. So, you know, the idea that socialism couldn't come about and it had to be a long period of time is clearly not true. And that magic money tree didn't exist. I put here change. What's stopping us now? This is a huge, huge subject, and I'm not sure it's easy to deal with it now. I think a lot of it is psychological, and it comes down to these inherent ideas that people have, and people, I think, are very, very frightened of change. So I think that is a big problem for socialists engaged in conversation with the people, because, you know, they really are frightened, and they'll perceive everything they've kind of built in their lives will evaporate around them. So I think if there's any messages that have got to come out of this, it's that, you know, what we've got to try and do as socialists, engaging people in conversation, is get on, stay with this idea of beauty and how, you know, how wonderful things could be. And as I said earlier as well, try and make them make their own arguments why they don't want what they got now. And then you can start to develop how things might eventually change. Okay. There's a little pile of stones in the next picture, which you may see. Now, that was really the same subject, really. You know, we're in recent years, obviously, everyone remembers the hockey stick graph that Al Gore presented in his Inconvenient Truth. And we all know as a fact now that in the last 100 or so years, Emissions have gone through the roof, and these problems are all accelerating. But this little picture is just near where I live, actually. It's up on a hill above where I live, and it's an old camp, Iron Age camp. But, you know, the point I'm making by showing you this is that, you know, people have been around a long, long time. They've had all sorts of different ways of living. But when you go back a long way, the earth, the planet, could provide all the things they needed without too much trouble. Even the river, the, you know, near where I live now, you could have gone down there in an evening, and with your hand, you could have scooped out a couple of fish without any problem at all. Now, clearly, that's not like that now. So what have we got to do to make more people, you know, if you like, come round to our way of thinking? I say make, that's the wrong word. Encourage or lead might be a better word. I don't know. But, you know, we all share that same belief, but unfortunately, the vast majority don't. But what would be nice is if we could kind of persuade people and have, you know, lead them along the line of, you know, how much more wonderful it could be. I've talked about the power of capitalism earlier on, and we goes flick by that. There's a couple of examples here. And it comes back around again to a good point of argument is you giving this example. So Mitsubishi, I used to think, made cars. Well, of course they do, but they don't only do that. Bluefin tuna are being stored by Mitsubishi at the moment in big deep freezers. Now, the reason for that is not because they want to make a, you know, give their workers a few cans of tuna to eat when they go home. It's because what can you say? So
sorry, Glenn, we just lost you for a minute. You dropped out for about 15 seconds. Could you repeat what you said, please? We got the tuna and we got Mitsubishi, but you dropped out.
I'm terribly sorry. Can you hear me now? Are you getting me now?
Yes, yes. Go ahead.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, just briefly then, Mitsubishi made cars, but they don't. They're a huge, huge company, and I'm hoping you can hear me now. So what I'm saying is that they've been storing this bluefin tuna, and as I was saying, not to give their workers a sort of nice weekend present of a little can of tuna or something. They've been storing it because when the animal, and it's predicted to become extinct, when it becomes extinct, these things will be worth a vast, vast amount of money. And that is the other bizarre thing about capitalism. So if you've got a creature or something that is becoming extinct, the irony is it's worth more the nearer it is to extinction. So therefore, something like the white rhinoceros will be hunted to the point of extinction because the last one's the most valuable. And that is the bizarre conundrum we face. And this is another thing that's worth discussing with people in relation to beauty. Okay, so the next one shows a similar thing. This is elephant tusks, and they're just being burnt. Now, I'm not saying they're useful or otherwise, but, you know, all those animals have had their tusks cut off. And because they're illegal, and they are being burnt, rather than used for anything. Again, a nonsensical thing. So you'll be pleased to know that this is the last slide. I tend to whittle on sometimes. So I put here a new dawn. Is it likely? I mean, with so few of us thinking like we do, I'm very conscious of that. And I think what we need to do, if I may suggest this, I'm not dictating it, but I think we do need to look at how we share our ideas with people and see whether there may be other avenues of conversation that bring people into our way of thinking. I'm very trying to pick my words carefully here because I don't want to sound like an evangelist or someone that's got, you know, member of some strange cult or something. I mean, to me, it's utterly logical, A, that, you know, how we perceive society being organized, but also it stands out like a sore thumb to me why it's so wrong now. But and the thing that baffles me is why isn't that thought shared by everybody else? Anyway, thank you very much.